May it please the court, good morning. My name is Andrew Hare. I'm a lawyer with the Public Defender's Office, and my registration number is 16891. I represent Albert Boone in this matter. The first issue I'd like to address is the first one raised in the briefs concerning the issue of defense counsel seeking an introduction of the DVD interview of Mr. Boone with Detective Maul. Just a brief summary of the kind of the background as to how this issue arose. The prosecution called Detective Maul, who's the lead investigator of this particular case, and the prosecution somewhat surprisingly asked Detective Maul, not so much that did you interview or talk to Mr. Boone, but then asked what happened during the interview. That is to say, they asked if he admit or deny the allegations, and Detective Maul said he denied the allegations. In cross-examination, defense counsel...
And that's all he said?
Correct.
One question and one answer. That was...
Well, and the answer is important because it gets to... It's a different... And kind of addresses two things out of the prosecution's ultimate objection on grounds of self-serving hearsay. In that it's different to ask if the detective asked questions or did the detective interview Mr. Boone. That's fine. That's not getting into the substance of it. The substance of the interview begins when the detective recounts that he denied the allegations. That's a substantive recounting of the interview. It would be different, again, if there were preparatory questions and answers that did not involve an assessment of the substance of the interview. And then that led defense counsel in cross-examination to follow up on that direct examination, asking, well, he answered all of the questions that you asked him. And at that point, the detective says, well, I wouldn't agree with that. I don't know that that would characterize that accurately. And defense counsel followed it up again with saying, well, there's a way we can figure out what the questions were and what the answers were because you videotaped recorded it and said yes. The attorney general is correct that there was a, basically, this issue didn't come up for a few more pages because defense counsel thought that the prosecution was going to introduce this interview in its own case. It declined, it decided not to, and that's when defense counsel sought to introduce it on his own. One stated he was going to recall Detective Maul in his case and have it introduced. Prosecution objected on the grounds of self-serving hearsay. The court sustained it. Defense counsel, in support of introduction, referred to the concept or principle of res gestae to give the jury a complete context as to what actually occurred during this interview, now that there was basically a characterization, the defense believing is a mischaracterization about how complete or accurate or full were the answers given by Mr. Boone in this particular matter.
Mr. Hare, is it your position that he did not deny the allegations? Was that accurate, he denied the allegations, or is it your position that somehow he did not deny the allegations?
Well, the denial of the allegations is correct. The then additional characterization by Detective Maul that he didn't actually answer fully. So there's actually, Detective Maul starts to basically kind of pull back from the substance of the answers. That is to say, how really, in terms of what denied meant, denied didn't mean that he was being forthcoming, perhaps probably truthful in his answers, because the Detective Maul was now characterizing it as not being Mr. Boone being completely forthright. So yes, he certainly does deny, and the video recording reflects that, but in terms of the accuracy or the nature of the denial and the how forthcoming Mr. Boone was, that really gets to the substance of and the nature of this particular problem here, because now the jury's left to believe that Mr. Boone has been less than forthcoming, and counsel, I think correctly, at least under one principle, res gestae. Others are more obvious, I think. Counsel did not use them, open the door, rule of completeness. But they all are.
The defense counsel did not argue those. You argue on appeal that it should have come in under the rules of opening the door or completeness. Trial counsel did not argue that. He just argued.
Counsel doesn't use either one of those phrases.
Okay.
Counsel used the phrase res gestae.
Did he argue that it was some kind of exception to the hearsay rule?
I don't know that he used cited it as an exception, but it would account as not necessarily an exception, but it wouldn't matter whether it was hearsay or not, because the point of these rules is about fairness, completeness, and basically The prosecution below didn't object on grounds of relevancy. All of these rules, the uniform, kind of uniformity of all of these rules is its relevancy. And is there prejudice to the party against whom it's going to be admitted? Well, it is relevant. It's not going to hurt the prosecution. It may not help their case. They may not like it, but they're the ones that opened the door. They're the ones that started it. They introduced this and injected this into the case. Under res justa, it is admissible under res justa. It gives complete context to the nature of this alleged offense and how it transpired, and an important part of the investigation leading up to the charges in this case in the trial. So it is admissible under res justa, whether or not it's hearsay. It's up to the jury to decide what weight to give it. If the prosecution wanted a limiting instruction on its use, they could seek that. But in any event, it is admissible under res justa. It is also admissible under the other principles that I've referred to in the brief.
Mr. Hare, I'd like to move, I hate to pull you away from your prepared argument,
sure.
But 15 minutes isn't long.
No.
And I'd like to ask you about the expert testimony.
Mm-hmm.
My question is somewhat more of curiosity. I'm wondering how the plain error rule relates to admission of evidence, and more specifically, would you agree that whether or not, or the degree to which certain evidence is prejudicial may depend somewhat on the defense strategy?
Well, certainly, I think under plain error circumstances, the court is required to basically consider the record as a whole, what transpired, how the case played out.
Right. I guess let me get to the point more quickly, because like the 15 minutes isn't long. Let's say, for example, in the plain error context, if it involves the admission of evidence, plain error has to be so egregious that a trial court would basically need to step in sua sponte. And so I'm asking if it's unclear as the evidence is developing what role that might play in relationship to the defense strategy. Is trial counsel supposed to jump in and second guess the strategy if it's a census error that's coming close to being prejudicial or evidence is close to being erroneous?
You're asking if the defense counsel should step in?
Yeah, the trial court.
The trial court, okay.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of plain error, the way that this case played out, mm-hmm. In terms of both the expert testimony and then I think importantly the closing argument, is the credibility obviously was an important issue. It was the pole star issue. There was no physical evidence. It was a question of, well, how the jury was going to kind of handle this. This particular kind of evidence, in Mr. Boone's view, is evidence that is crossing the line to an adoption of that the alleged victim maybe actually is telling the truth, that the percentage that it's offered by the expert is so minimal that it leaves the jury no room but to say this expert is saying, given the facts of this case, that this individual is telling the truth.
Even though she doesn't specifically deal with the individual?
Correct. A so-called blind expert.
Mm-hmm.
Because it ends up being, again, I think in context, and I didn't make a cumulative error argument, but it is important in deciding a case-by-case basis whether in a case there is plain error, whether it's affected substantial rights of the accused, that in the closing argument, and I can get to that as well, I wasn't necessarily going to, but the closing argument where defense counsel actually addresses the expert testimony and says, look, I'm not going to say that this individual is lying. I'm not going to get into truthfulness. I'm not going to say those things. What I am going to do is recount the facts of this case, and then he uses phrases as the Attorney General does recount in her answer brief, phrases like made up or trouble, et cetera. And so when defense counsel makes a point of not bringing it into the case or not injecting really inappropriate characterizations like lying, and so forth, using those things that Liggett points out that are other reasons for why a witness would come to court and say things and make allegations and accuse the defendant, then it is not appropriate and responsive to say that the defense is now calling the complaining witness a liar repeatedly over and over and over to characterize that defense argument. That's inappropriate. But I don't know if that answers your question entirely about expert testimony and whether a court, I don't agree necessarily where that a court should necessarily, I don't think the test is whether a court should sua sponte step in and say, I'm going to stop this or I'm not going to allow
it. Isn't that what Frady says, United States versus Frady?
says...
The United States Supreme Court case says that the plain error has to be so egregious that you would basically expect a trial court to sua sponte correct it.
Well, I suppose that's one way of reading it, but Colorado has not really said that this is the way we're going to characterize it. I think plain error is case by case. I think that in this particular instance where the expert is, again, in a percentage, in a case in which statistic evidence is being offered and it's so minimal that it's basically the equivalent of saying that this particular complaining witness, short of, I think the expert said, the only cases in which this kind of allegation is made is where the complaining witness is mentally ill.
In which there was no suggestion here that she was mentally ill. That was kind of a throwaway from the expert.
Well, it's a throwaway, but the point is that it further reduces down to a minimalist kind of situation where a person can come into court and make these allegations.
Sure.
You've got to be mentally ill. It has to be so minimal. So it is the equivalent. This is Mr. Boone's argument that it's the equivalent of saying this complaining witness, the expert doesn't have to meet the complaining witness, but not knowing any information coming from the complaining witness or from the prosecution in terms of discovery that this complaining witness is either mentally ill or fits within that particular realm.
The expert's testimony was basically 97% to 98% of the children don't lie, and the other 2 or 3% are mentally ill. Something to that.
Correct.
And she was not mentally ill, therefore.
Correct.
And your position is it's plain error analysis because no objection. So even though this was obvious, nobody made an objection to it.
Correct.
And I think what Judge Boris is asking is, then what is the trial judge supposed to do? Step in and say, I am not going to allow this testimony, or counsel, do you have an objection or something to that effect?
Well, I think this particular kind of information, this kind of evidence coming from an expert in this area of law, there's a lot of this out there. And so an expert may have an expertise and have this opinion based upon their research and analysis. But whether it, and this gets to plain error, it gets to a question, should counsel move for a Shrek hearing on whether or not this kind of evidence is both admissible in the first instance? Are there qualifications sufficient for the foundation of this expert? And is it something that's reliable as a gatekeeper can come to the jury? But this gets back to plain error. And so a court hearing this for the first time, I don't know that a court would step in sua sponte. Hearing in a case like this is almost kind of typical recounting of expertise and narrative about alleged victims and complaining witnesses in sexual assault cases.
But for the purposes of our analysis and under existing Colorado law on plain error, what we have to decide is, if it was obvious, did it affect the substantial rights of the defendant in this case as to cast doubt on the reliability of the verdict? What's your position on that?
Well, in this particular case, it does, because it narrows down the possibility. It's almost dealing with the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, dealing with the facts of the case that we have. It leaves the jury with virtually no choice but to come to the conclusion based upon this testimony, at least to influence their decision, given this body of testimony that, in fact, Mr. Boone committed these offenses.
And did the prosecutor argue that in closing?
Yes, the prosecution did argue that Mr. Boone was guilty of looking.
No, that the expert witness testimony should be believed by the jury.
I don't recall as far as closing whether they said the jury should believe the expert's testimony. But certainly the credibility contest that was going on, it was a substantial part of the prosecution's case, an important part. I see I have about a minute and a half left. I'd like to reserve my written time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, my name is Kathy Gillespie. I'm here on behalf of the people. My registration number is 26109. I want to get right into the expert issue. Judge Boris, that you pointed out, but I want to just take a step back for a second and make sure we have an accurate understanding of what exactly took place with the expert. Candy Moore was the expert who testified. When she came up to on her direct examination and the prosecution wanted to qualify her as an expert, defense counsel in their voir dire in front of the jury asked Ms. Moore about various articles and whether or not she was familiar with them. And one of them was the reliable and fictitious issues of sexual abuse in children. The defense asked a couple of questions. There was no objection, and she was qualified as an expert. Ms. Moore then just went through the general categories that we see in a lot of sex assaults, the various topics. Before she testified, defense counsel asked if she was going to be talking about this victim specifically because they hadn't gotten any reports, and the prosecutor said no. The purpose of calling this expert was to educate the jury, get some general background information.
Where did the defense counsel ask this question? In the voir dire?
In the voir dire of the expert witness.
Okay.
So after the prosecution had laid their foundation, the defense attorney got up and had a couple of extra questions. During the prosecution's foundational questions, nothing was asked about any of the fabrication or false allegations. Towards the end of her direct examination, the prosecutor did ask Ms. Moore about fabrication, whether or not it's something that she typically sees based on her research and her clinical practice. She said that it was typically 1 to 3% of the cases, that it was certainly possible, but that it was rare. I disagree that the only reason why a child would fall into that 1 to 3% was mental health. She talked about incentives for why somebody might falsely accuse. She talked about custody battles, heated divorce cases. If there are mental health issues with the child, they may misinterpret something, they may recall something different, they may lie about what they see in order to negotiate their position. She also talked about how younger children may talk about certain things and that they're not actually disclosing sexual abuse, but that adults may misunderstand what the child is trying to relay to them. So she gave a variety of different reasons for why that 1 to 3% may exist. Then, and keep in mind, through direct and cross, Ms. Moore stated multiple times she'd never met the victim, never seen any of the facts, didn't know anything about her. This was just general information.
Ms. Galevsky, I understand that the witness made clear that she hadn't dealt directly with the victim, but given the statistical numbers that she provided, how can we say that this is not error under the Snook case, which is a Supreme Court authority, I believe?
It is. Snook and Retrain both have kind of make this general statement that the testimony that children tend to fabricate sexual assault shouldn't be given. I think when you look at Retrain and Snook and the nature of that expert testimony, in both of those cases, the expert gave more of a definitive answer. In Retrain, it was more of an erotic disclosure, and the prosecution asked about the nature of the details that the child provided. And in Snook, the expert went so far as to say that in order to give those kind of exotic or erotic details, the child has to have a basis in fact for that. So it has to have the experience, which equates to a definitive answer that if a child is giving that kind of detail, they have been sexually assaulted. And the same thing was true in the Watrain case. In that case, the child psychiatrist had actually interviewed the child and done a bunch of testing. And it was a little convoluted, but it was basically a scale of hyper-reporting. And ultimately what the expert ended up saying was, it's hard for me to imagine that an 8-year-old child, which was the age of the child in that case, could put together this type of plan falsely or in order to get someone in trouble for sex assault. When you look at the Ashley case, Kuhn and Higa, which were never overruled or never even addressed by the Supreme Court in Retrain and Snook, I think the difference between those two cases, between the two Supreme Court cases and this other Colorado Appeals case law, which keeps saying that the trend is to allow this kind of general testimony about children not likely to fabricate, it doesn't equate to this child, it wasn't possible for this child to do it. Yes, it is saying that it's rare, it only happens in a select number of cases, but like in this case, the defense brought out all sorts of things about this child's troubled background. She had been sexually assaulted before, she was getting into trouble with her parents, her for adopted parents, things like that, which could clearly put her in that 1 to 3% of cases where children do tend to fabricate. So I think that's a distinction that could be made between the Supreme Court cases and the Colorado Court of Appeals cases. Yes, sir.
So, Counselor, Mr. Gillespie, are you saying that it was not obvious to the trial court in light of Snook and Latrain because of the way you just distinguished them? Or are you saying that it was not obvious to the trial court because the Court of Appeals has a separate line of cases that seem to differ from the Supreme Court?
I think that's one argument, is that that's part of why it wasn't an obvious error. But I think in this case it goes so much farther as to why, that even if this court were to say that Latrain is a much more general statement than I believe it was based on the facts of that case. Here, the defense starts their opening statement with, this is a case about false accusations. It's a case about false accusations by a daughter. It's a case about false accusation by a daughter about her father. And here are the reasons why it's false. That is also the last statement that the defense makes in their closing argument. And they carry that theme all the way through. They talk about the defendant's impotence, his heart problems and the medication and the things that, the issues that causes, talks about this child having been sexually abused before and whether or not there was transference, that this was a vindictive act because her father, the adopted father of the defendant, was home and was being the disciplinarian while she was being homeschooled. There was no objection. There was extensive follow-up and cross-examination. The defense brought up a Denver 1980s Denver study that said that percentage of false allegations is really closer to 10 to 15%, talked about it being higher in teenagers, and asked the expert a variety of questions about that, whether or not a failure to bond with an adoptive parent would be something that they would consider. And again, this expert was very clear that she wasn't talking about this particular victim. And I think when you look through all of the defense strategy and the theme of this case, there's just no way that this particular evidence would have cast doubt on the reliability of the verdict. It essentially helped both. I mean, Ms. Moore did say it was rare, but this case had a lot of the factors that Ms. Moore said are present in that 1 to 3%. So it's really no different. I mean, I know when we see child sex assault case, everybody, you know, pulls up the reins and stops a little short, but there's no separate rules of evidence for child sex assault cases. And, you know, we do this all the time with expert witnesses, shaken baby syndrome. The defendant stands up and says the child fell off the dresser. The expert stands up and says, based on research and my clinical experience, these types of injuries don't come from this. Yes, the inference is always there.
Yes, but this is a direct credibility issue. What Ms. Moore was saying here essentially was 99% of the time, about 99% of the time, these victims are telling the truth. And you can say she's not talking about victim A, B in this case, but then this testament would have no relevance if it wasn't about victim A, B in this case. So obviously this just conveys to the jury that victim A, B is telling the truth. And it seems to me, unless you can distinguish that from what was said in Whitrain or Snook, it falls into the category of error. The question, I guess, is whether it was plain error.
Well, I think the difference is that in what they're doing is dispelling a common myth surrounding these sex assault cases, that children will make these allegations up all the time. I mean, that's essentially what the defendant's theory was. So this is a troubled teenager, and we all know teenagers lie about this stuff to get out of it all the time. Now, I agree with you, it is much closer to credibility than, say, just delayed disclosure and things like that. But all of those factors are what are commonly argued by defense counsel as to why this victim shouldn't be believed for one reason or another. And all the expert's doing is based on research saying, hey, it's not as common as the typical layperson may think it is. Here's where we typically see it. But it's not a common occurrence. And I think in this case, it happened just the way it should. Defense counsel stands up and tries to poke holes in that 1 to 3%. What about this factor? What about this factor? Would this consider? And she kept saying, yes, all of those are things that you should look at. In which case, the case is then handed to the jury. And another important point about this is at the end of Ms. Moore's testimony, there were four jury questions, and based on one of those questions, the judge read the credibility instruction and explained to the jury, again, that it was their job to determine the credibility, and that the expert witness, while qualified to give a certain kind of opinion, it was still up to them as to how to weight that opinion. So all that information is collected by the jury, and they go back into the jury room, and then they have to decide, one, whether or not they believe the expert and want to consider that testimony. But the expert also gives them a lot of factors that they to help them with that credibility determination. What should you be looking at? Is there a custody? Are there mental health issues going on, et cetera, et cetera? And that's exactly what they did here. It was just one more tool to help assess these types of cases and to give the jury some factors to look at. But it was still left to the jury. The court was very clear that it wasn't the expert's call. The expert was very clear. Don't know about this victim. Here's just what we see from the research. So I do think there needs to be a distinction between Wittrain and Snook and then these other Colorado Court of Appeals cases that have, where it's not as definitive as it was in Wittrain and Snook. But even if the court isn't willing to go there, I think here, defense strategy absolutely should be included as something to look at when you're looking at whether or not plain error exists. And I think the way the defense approached this, asked about the fictitious allegations right off the bat in their voir dire, their opening statement, their entire theory of the defense, whether you phrase it as the victim is lying or it's a false accusation, the end result is that was their theory, was that this teenager made this up to get her adopted father into trouble and to get out of the house.
Just real quick, would you characterize this as an overwhelming evidence case if you set aside the expert testimony in this case?
I would. I disagree with defense counsel that there was no physical evidence. I think it was the ER doctor who testified, said that the damage to the young girl's hymen was consistent with a penetrating trauma. So there was physical evidence in this case, as I'm sure the court knows, is pretty unique. There were also multiple disclosures. This child didn't go to the police. She disclosed to a friend of hers, who disclosed to a parent, and the parent is the one that called the police. Her brother, who was present in the house too, the victim described that the defendant would take her into the bedroom during the day alone and lock the door under the guise of disciplining her. And her brother, while he testified that he never saw any sexual abuse, confirmed that that took place multiple times, that he saw them go into the bedroom together, and that he was never treated that way by the adopted father. So I think, taking that into consideration as well, plus all of the limiting instructions that the court gave, and all the ways that the defense used this, and the whole theory of the defense being that this child falsely accused, I don't think the court can find that there was plain error here. I don't think it was obvious. I think there is still some confusion in the case law between all of those Court of Appeals decisions and Wittrain and Snook, and really that's the only distinction I can find, is that the experts in Wittrain and Snook were much more definitive in their testimony than was the case here.
Okay. Was there a Schreck hearing in this case? Was there an objection even before trial to the validity of the studies and the expert witnesses?
There was not a Schreck hearing. There was not an objection to the validity of the studies. To be honest with you, I don't remember if they even requested a Schreck hearing. But I know they didn't. One wasn't given, and there was no discussion about this literature prior to trial being a problem. I'm just going to stand on my briefs on the other issues unless the court has any questions about those.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think you have about 1:15, counsel.
May it please the court. The evidence in this case is anything but overwhelming. The pediatrician that examined AB reported that there were non-abusive reasons for the appearance of AB's hymen, that the vaginal penetration was one possible reason, but in the end the examination was, in the pediatrician's words, indeterminate for the cause of the appearance. That's not overwhelming evidence, and that's not consistent with the Attorney General's characterization of that particular witness. If this was not based on myth, defense counsel was basing his argument about AB and the allegations based upon the circumstances of their family, the two adopted children, the troubled nature. A lot of this is recounted both in witnesses by Ms. Boone, but also in the DVD.
Mr. Hare, in that regard, during closing argument, didn't the defense counsel specifically choose not to contest the expert testimony that these sorts of allegations were rare and then argue the circumstances?
Well, the defense counsel did at the outset say that he wasn't going to engage in whether an argument of whether AB was telling the truth or not, basically, in summary, that he was going to move to basically an accounting of the facts of this particular case and how the jury should assess AB's credibility in that context. So he did not attack that or take on, so to speak, the expert witness in that sense, Your Honor. I see my time has expired. I would ask the court to reverse Mr. Boone's conviction.
Thank you, counsel. This case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.